I'm Hillary McClure, Multimedia Director at Cybercrime Magazine. I'm here today with Dave Kennedy, founder of TrustedSec and co-founder and chief hacking officer of Binary Defense Systems. TrustedSec is an information security consulting team at the forefront of attack simulations with a focus on strategic risk management. Their goal is to help organizations defend against threats of all kinds and change the security industry for the better. To learn more about TrustedSec, visit TrustedSec.com. Welcome, Dave. So great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So, Dave, you started out in the Marines working for the intelligence community. You're a former NSA hacker and now the founder of an information security consulting firm. And you have appearances on many high-profile media outlets. So walk us through your career.
Yeah, you know, it's been a really fortunate career. I started off really at an early age, getting into computers and building my own computers, and you know, getting into programming and playing before we had graphics, online games that were all text and things of that effect. So I was really always into computers my whole life, and I got out of high school and decided to join the military side and scored really high on my ASVAB test, which is an aptitude test for which kind of job you can go into in the military. And I ended up going into the intelligence community and the intelligence community, when I went in, you know, they recognized quickly I had a lot of knack and skill for computers. And so I started getting into signals intelligence and cryptography breaking, and then eventually what became, you know, more of the cyber warfare capabilities out there. And I deployed twice to Iraq for intelligence related missions, spent a lot of time in the Middle East focusing on intelligence related missions. And then got out and, I started at a small consulting shop, then eventually became chief security officer for Diebold Incorporated. I always throw the caveat that I came out in after the voting machine issues that happened there and helped build their cybersecurity program from the ground up, which was awesome. We had an international, global cybersecurity team. And then eventually started my own two companies, TrustedSec and Binary Defense, which, you know, we focus on protecting, everything from small to medium-sized businesses all the way to, you know, the largest companies in the world against what we're seeing today with a lot of the cybersecurity threats. But I've been really fortunate throughout my career. You know, I've been both on the technical, non-technical side. I open source a lot of exploitation frameworks for testing your security programs, like the Social Engineer Toolkit, Magic Unicorn. I wrote the book, Metasploit, the Penetration Tester's Guide, which was the number one best-selling security book for a number of years on Amazon. I'm on the news quite frequently. In fact, I was just on Fox yesterday, CNBC the night, day before, and then Fox the day before that on the whole sunburst issue that's been going on. So I've been in the news quite frequently, testifying in front of Congress. And funny stories, I helped out with the TV show Mr. Robot. So I got to work with Rami Malek and Christian Slater. And I've also been in a Chris Brown rap video, believe it or not.
That's so cool. Well, that's great. I actually want to talk to you about a few of those things you just mentioned. But that's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Fun times. Yeah, it's been a great career. And, my whole passion has always been cybersecurity and trying to make the world a better place and keep organizations, people, and everybody else protected against a lot of the threats that we see out there today.
Absolutely. And I know that this doesn't happen anymore, but you founded DerbyCon in 2010, and actually, which held its last conference in September of 2019, which honestly happened to be perfect timing to wrap a conference.
Great timing,
considering,
right?
considering what 2020 did for conferences. But I know the closing was due in part to some negativity and disruption, but also I'm sure it was a very huge logistical burden and beast to oversee and manage with everything else you have going on. But I wanted to talk about that. Not to get into what happened, but have you seen COVID-19 bring together some of these communities, help us, you know, has it healed anything now that we're kind of in this shared, difficult situation at all? I'm trying to be like an optimist, I guess, in asking that, but.
Well, you know, DerbyCon was some of the best times of my life running one of the largest conferences out there. I mean, we'd sell out tickets in 3 seconds, you know, wow, for 3,500 people. And, it was an incredible adventure, and we never planned on it to be this huge, massive event. You know, yeah, we decided, you know, we wanted it to be this small kind of community driven thing. And then we realized quickly that that's what the industry was hungry for, was that knowledge sharing, the openness, the ability to, you know, share your own research or to be brand new in the industry and feel like you're accepted as part of, you know, a greater good or, calling. And so, you know, DerbyCon really, really took off. And, you know, we've seen this a lot with a lot of conferences, you know, just the polarization just in general, of the world, you know, has caused friction and issues. So having to deal with, you know, just 3,500 people coming together with different conflicting views and opinions and things to that effect, you know, just, you know, it, after a while, it puts a toll on you when you're trying to manage, you know, run a massive conference and deal with, you know, what comes in day in and day out of these types of large events. And so, you know, we found that, you know, instead of it happening for fun, you know, it took a lot of time out of our efforts and it wasn't becoming as fun anymore. So after 9 years, you know, we decided, hey, it's been great. We've had a great 9-year run. It's one of the most popular InfoSec conferences out there. Let's go out, you know, in a blaze of glory and in a high note and, you know, focus our efforts elsewhere. And, you know, what was great about DerbyCon is, you know, we raised more money for charities than any other security conference ever, for various charity events, helped out, you know, with the hurricanes that were happening in Puerto Rico with the destruction there. We had people, you know, flying in and, emergency rations and things of that effect. And, you know, Hackers for Charity and Innocent Lives Foundation and all of these different charity groups. And we actually had a reserve of money at the end of DerbyCon. We donated all to our favorite charity groups at the end. So it was hundreds of thousands of dollars that went directly to charities when we closed. So it was a great run and we made a big impact on the community. And, you know, to your point with the whole COVID situation, you know, a lot of things have gone to remote. So, you know, we're not having conferences in person, which, you know, I've done a ton of conferences that aren't in person now. And I would say that, you know, I like the mix of in-person and non-in-person. I think when we do it in person, you get a lot more personable with somebody. You can, yeah, you know, obviously see their interaction. It's a little bit more difficult to present, you know, remotely, but I do think that the breadth of conferences that have come out, you know, have made it a little bit easier for these types of events to occur versus, you know, what we've seen in the past. But I do hope it kind of goes back to a little bit of a norm where, you know, we see more conferences in person again and you get that human interaction and hopefully we do come together more. You know, I think, you know, we're a growing industry. You know, there's a lot of things that are changing as far as diversity and more people coming into the industry that we haven't seen before, which is an amazing thing. All of those things are very good positives to see in this industry and it's for everybody. And one thing I think that will definitely continue to change as time goes on.
Absolutely. And so one of your titles is Chief Hacking Officer at Binary Defense Systems. And obviously there's a lot going on right now in current events with hacking and breaches, but to start, and I guess you as the expert, correct me if I'm wrong at this being a place to start, but to start, how have most wide-ranging attacks been initiated? Because it seems like there might be a misconception that historically it's like some super high-tech, you know, breach right off the bat.
You know, we see a wide variety of attacks, you know, at both organizations. We have a lot of visibility into what's happening. And one thing I could say is that, yeah, you see on the news where these massive, super sophisticated hacks happen. But most of the time, you know, I would say predominantly most of the time, I'd say 95 to 98% of the time, they aren't sophisticated hacks. They're very easy hacks that target individuals or users through phishing or social engineering. Okay. They're, you know, taking advantage of things like weak passwords and, you know, lack of multi-factor authentication in certain areas. You know, those are the main breaches that we see out there today for most organizations. It's the basics that are biting us when it comes to large-scale computer breaches. And you look at ransomware as a great example. You know, ransomware started off very non-sophisticated a number of years ago where they were targeting, you know, individual people and very small businesses that may only have a few different people. But, you know, we're seeing now that they're going after large organizations. We had Universal Health Systems, we had Garmin, we had a number of different breaches occur, you know, in very large companies. And, you know, these attacks, you know, they're focusing on targeting individual people, you know, getting them to enter in their credentials or getting them to open up a document. And then from there, you know, we still run into the issue around when one person gets compromised, it impacts the whole organization. It's kind of like, not to use a COVID-19 reference, but, you know, if you're in a household and one person gets sick, everybody gets sick, right? You know, typically. So, you know, it's very much like that from these types of breaches that we're seeing out there today, where, you know, one person literally becomes the catalyst for these major breaches that are occurring. And they're, again, not sophisticated at all. I mean, I would say that, you know, it takes an average hacker, you know, that's probably, you know, around the 80% of the, you know, hackers that are out there from a demographics perspective, from an average hacking perspective, to do these types of attacks. So, you know, you can research online, you can download tools, you can do everything that is already publicly available and have a wide level of success going into organizations. It's not 0 days. It's not, you know, these massive hacks that you're seeing now. Don't get me wrong. You know, what's happening with the Sunburst attack in Russia, you know, allegedly Russia, you know, attacking multiple organizations and companies through SolarWinds. that's a very highly complex attack, but we don't see those, you know, very often. They're usually run-of-the-mill type attacks that should be easily prevented.
And so are the vulnerables solely digital, or can they also be physical? And this might be different now just with the remote working world we live in, but I guess, you know, again, historically.
You know, physical aspects are obviously very much a risk for organizations. Just, but we don't see those types of attacks as much. You know, it's easier to hack a person from, you know, a different country where you don't have to worry about extradition laws or being arrested.
Okay.
But at the same time, you know, we do see physical security exposures leading to direct compromises of infrastructure as well. You know, we've seen Barnes and Nobles where their, you know, point of sale systems were manipulated and hacked. You know, we've seen historically, you know, breaches occur directly from the physical aspect. So physical definitely plays a major role, and maybe not necessarily from a state espionage, you know, nation state attack perspective, but definitely an avenue that you know, if I were an attacker and I had access to an internal infrastructure, you know, that would be a lot easier than having to send a bunch of phishes out to individuals to go about it. And that's one piece here that I don't think a lot of people look at from their entire security program, which is the malicious insider threat that a lot of companies or organizations have. You know, when you look at risk, you look at, you know, impact, likelihood, and countermeasures that you have in place. And, you know, while the impact for a malicious insider is extremely high, the likelihood for most organizations is low. It's very similar to like the sunburst attack. You know, when you say, well, my supply chain, you know, I'm going to trust my supply chain. I'm going to look at their overall security program to see that, make sure that they have a healthy security program. And so my likelihood then is going to be low. But then we see something like this happen, and now, you know, an adversary has had access to our infrastructure for 6 months going undetected. So, you know, I think our risk models are a little bit out of whack, and I don't think a lot of companies pay a lot of emphasis on physical security and the potential implications of that, or somebody that may go rogue within your organization. And those are all important things that we need to look at from our threat models to say, you know, and reevaluate this today in 2021 and say, you know, we need to put better protections in place, both from our end users, from our physical location perspective, as well as our third-party trusted vendors, to ensure that we're really trying to protect our infrastructure in our organization.
Great. And so that's really helpful to have in context. And then in addition to that, I know that you have done some what you call MacGyver-style hacks with some IoT devices and things like that. So tell us about those, because they're very intriguing to me.
Oh, there's so much fun. You know, when we get to do assessments, you know, when we go into organizations and we attack them, we look at all types of threat models, and we look at, you know, what's the best way to go after an organization. Sometimes, you know, that's physical. Sometimes that's, you know, implanting things. We had a customer where, you know, they actually wanted us to attack their Swift infrastructure to simulate, you know, an actual transfer, like to emulate the Swift wire hacks that happened before in the past, where, you know, they're able to, you know, attack, you know, and do things. Now we couldn't go to the actual transfer part because then we're breaking federal law. but getting down to the actual point of being able to do that and knowing you could is really crazy. I remember one physical assessment that I was on. It was a branch office for a bank, and it was like 2 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, we'd essentially remotely hacked into this company, and we disabled the security system for this branch office. It took us like a month to get into there.
Oh, wow.
And we disabled the branch office physical security location, and we got into the actual branch location. And it took us about, we have this device that basically mounts onto the actual vault inside of a bank, and it tries every combination. It takes about 3 hours or so to go through every combination. And eventually we cracked the safe and opened up the safe, and there's pictures of me holding, you know, bags of cash basically. you know, that I could have easily taken and walked away with no detection, because we had the camera systems disabled. We had the alarm system disabled, and, you know, literally I'm holding bags of cash. And then unfortunately we had to put the bags of cash back and, you know, let the customer know that, hey, we had bags of cash in our hands. So, you know, we get to do some really fun things that make a big difference. I'm trying to think some other stories here. There was another organization that we were going into, was for an energy company. And this is one of my favorite ones because it incorporates both physical and social engineering. And we had to go over some barbed wire fences. So we basically put like these carpets or rugs over the barbed wire fences. We climb the barbed wire fences, and we get access to this door, and we crowbar a door open on the backside. And it wasn't supposed to be that, by the way. We get to the door, and we didn't realize that we couldn't pick it because it was only a one-sided door, which was our fault on that side. But you run into those situations, right? And you got to overcome it. So, yeah. And the customer allowed us to to do physical damage to the to the location, whatever we could do to get access to the building. And so we get access to the building, and we're in there for about 2 hours, like literally playing cat and mouse with the security guard. The security guard's like doing tours and, you know, has flashlights, you know, and this is super late at night. It's a 24-hour facility. And so we're basically like I'm literally tucked away in one room, and there's lights being shined down the hallway. I'm hiding underneath a desk with my other partner that we're breaking in this. And we get access to the executive area. We get access to the data center. You know, we plant all of our back doors into the systems. You know, we get access to their SCADA infrastructure, which is, you know, where their all of their industrial control systems are at, that we could potentially shut down, you know, the energy sector for them. And so we had meticulously gone, you know, into this whole area. And at the very end, you know, we're dressed up literally as burglars. I mean, I have a black beanie on, I have lockpicks in my hand, I have a black backpack, I'm dressed in camo, I have a throat mic so I can communicate with my partner as I'm going through. I mean, like literally a military operation.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as we're going out, there's like these two-sided doors. And the one door, you know, there's like a little crack in it. And I look through the door really quick just to make sure there's nobody on the other side. And literally, as I'm looking through the crack in the door, I can see a security guard walking through the door. And so he walks right into us, basically. And this is, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning. And literally, you know, they're armed guards. So he's got a gun. And he looks at us and he's like, whoa, what are you guys doing here? And he goes to grab his gun. You know, and he's kind of holding it in that position of like, hey, I'm about to draw.
Right.
And I'm like, whoa, man, hey, you know, just, hey, it's Dave. I work in IT, you know, late night,
like,
you know, just had a lot of stuff going on. You know, one of the servers crashed. Everything's good. Sorry to scare you. I didn't, and we were going through the same time. What a coincidence. And he's like, oh man, you guys scared the living heck out of me. You know, have a good night, you know, and thanks for keeping our systems up. Hey, no problem, man. We walk out of the building, you know, full access to the entire company. So, you know, those are the fun stories that, wow, that was cool. Right.
That's great. That sounds like a movie for sure, but real life.
Yeah, it felt like it. Yeah.
Wow. So I guess that leads me to a question. Are people, I guess, why are people so trusting of folks when they share that they're in IT? Because I also read the story where you socially engineered a bank teller just by sharing how you were on the IT team and what have you. So it seems like there is kind of a pattern there where people are very trusting of those who say they're in IT. Is that wrong?
Yeah. Well, you know, culturally, you know, the thing with IT is you expect IT people to be kind of introverts and suspicious in general. Just because, you know, like, you know, the typical computer nerd guy or girl that you look at is, you know, not usually a socially interactive person, may come off socially awkward. So IT people are a great person to emulate, because they may come off socially awkward, you know, and that's a normal kind of thing in that type of behavior. So, you know, I think IT people are great to emulate, but it goes down to a bigger, I don't know necessarily say it's a problem, but it's how we are as a society is that, you know, we are trusting of individuals unless they trigger some warnings of, hey, we're lying to them or something just doesn't seem right. Right.
Yeah.
So unless you trip those, you know, from a neuro-linguistic programming perspective. NLP is a science behind how we interact with people and kind of how we're subliminally programmed as human beings. You know, those types of things, unless we're triggering those alarms, people are typically trusting of us. It's the same thing of like, if you're walking down the street and there's a person behind you, you don't expect the person behind you to, you know, punch you in the back, right?
Right.
It just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So, you know, until somebody punches you in the back, you know, So unless you have those radars up, you know, we are typically very trusting of individuals. And that's the thing. And that's why social engineering, you know, has always been so effective, is we're trusting until you violate that. So if you impersonate somebody of authority, like there's a whole bunch of times where I will sit there and I'll wait in a building and I'll look for a younger individual, like an intern or somebody that's just freshly out of school. And I'll dress up in a suit and tie. And I'll be on the phone, you know, pretending that I'm talking about something really important about the company itself or big leadership changes or things of that effect. Mm-hmm. And I'll tailgate behind that person. And the person knows that somebody shouldn't be tailgating behind. They're supposed to badge in. But because I seem like I'm in a position of authority, they won't challenge me because they're newer, younger in that position. They don't want to cause any friction.
Right.
So all of these things work very well when it comes to social engineering. And it's just societally how we're programmed. And that's why education awareness is so important. Empowering our employees to be able to challenge situations like that, being aware of the types of situations that we're seeing, especially from a phishing perspective, you know, like, you know, if HR is demanding you go to the site within 24 hours, and you're not going to receive your medical benefits. That's just not going to happen. You know, they're not going to do that to you as a company with no prior notice. So, you know, we have to look out for these things, and we have to be aware that attackers take, you know, a sense of urgency, and they really want you to do something based on a sense of urgency. And we just need to take a step back and say, hey, is this really legitimate? Let's get some confirmation here.
It's very interesting. And the NLP, is that correct? That's super interesting to me, because I remember when I was in college, I had heard a story about a woman who was walking to her car at the parking garage, and someone that was walking toward her. She walked past them. They stopped pretended to try and tie their shoe, but then they turned around and started following her after that. And after I heard that story, if I ever saw someone bend down to tie their shoe, I was like running the other way. I was like, oh no.
It's amazing how stories. Yeah. It's amazing how stories and things that have happened to other people or things to us really change our patterns of behavior. Yeah. And unless it does happen to us, unless we've been phished before, we've been a victim to something like cybercrime, you know, typically we don't change our patterns of behavior. That's why, you know, education awareness programs of changing behavior, or even when you make a security change that impacts the whole company, people get really upset. You know, like when you implement multi-factor authentication, people are like, this is so stupid. Security, you know, security is just changing my life and making it more difficult, when, you know, really we're just trying to protect everybody from themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Interesting. And you've also been known to call volunteers onto stage when you've held panels and within minutes figure out a ton of what most would feel is very private information, even including social security numbers. Is this magic? I laugh asking that. I feel like, I don't know if you're familiar with my cousin Vinny on like the magic beanstalk beans. We're like, is this magic? Like, because people might view it
very
that
much
way.
Like that. It seems like it, right?
Yeah.
You know, and it's like a magic trick that you're doing on stage. And I love doing those. You know, when I was growing up into the security industry, there was a hacker group called the Cult of the Dead Cows, or CDC. And they were this like really flamboyant, like crazy, you know, on stage with guitars and, you know, skull heads and things like that. And they were just a show, right? I mean, they're literally magicians, and they would like release these tools and hacks that were like magic. And
that's cool.
And, you know, as a younger kid growing up in this industry, I'm like, I want to be like those folks that were on stage doing magic tricks. Right. And David Copperfield was actually a really big inspiration for me. So, you know, so when I call people up on stage, you know, for me, it's about awareness around what's actually public out there. So a lot of times I'll call somebody up on stage and I'll be like, hey, what's your first and last name? And that's all I know.
Yeah.
And from that, I'll you know, grab where they live, their, you know, their parents' phone numbers, their email addresses, their full social security number, you know, maybe, you know, potentially financial records, you know, embarrassing photos sometimes, you know, I don't show it on stage.
Yeah.
But I'm, you know, I pull back all this data within seconds, and it's random people in the audience. I don't have like an implant or somebody in the stage I'm doing it to. It's random people in the audience. I have no idea if it's going to work or not. And that resonates with people because, you know, for social security numbers and our personal information, we think that is ours. And that it's heavily protected, when in fact, social security numbers are extremely easy to get online. And it's, you know, you can either pay for it for about 5 cents a record, or, you know, you can use, you know, dark web searches or other things to get people's personal information out there. And, you know, here's the thing, if somebody calls you and says, hey, so-and-so, this is so-and-so from Chase Fraud Services. You know, I'm just verifying last four of your social is, you know, 1234. And you're like, yep, your birthday's this. Okay. You know, you're going to automatically believe that whoever I am, I'm Chase Fraud Service, because I have that information for you. And then you're going to give me whatever I want. You're going to give me your credit card number. You're going to give me whatever I ask for based on the situation that's there. So, you know, we have to be aware that that type of information is readily available. And same thing, you know, I did a thing at DEF CON a number of years ago. It was one of my favorite talks that I've ever given. And one of my good friends is Kevin Mitnick, who's a famous hacker, you know, in the industry. And so what we did is I called Kevin up on stage, and we live social engineered one of our customers that gave us permission to go and do it. And so we called an individual up, and Mitnick did the social engineering, and I did the technical hacking piece of it. And we were actually able to hack somebody in less than like 30 seconds live on stage in front of 14,000 people in the audience.
Wow.
And that was just an awesome, awesome one too. So, you know, the implications are obviously real. The situations are real, and demonstrating that and showing people really brings a lot of awareness to what's possible.
Wow. Really interesting. And speaking of showing people what's possible, you mentioned earlier, but you helped out on the show Mr. Robot, which was a huge show and really exposed people to a lot of, you know, different things that they weren't super aware of in cybersecurity and hacking. What was that experience like?
You know, what was so cool about Mr. Robot is, first of all, we didn't even know, like, when Mr. Robot first came out, we didn't know who the actors were.
Oh.
We just got a letter from USA basically saying, hey, can we use, you know, some of your tools and some of your talks and things like that as skits and things like that on the show? And I said, sure, absolutely. You know, we sent a bunch of t-shirts and stuff like that and swag to the show. And then eventually I ended up helping with season one and some of the skits that they were doing for that. And there's actually one that never ended up airing, which is really cool. I can go into that. But what was really cool is they employed a lot of great people in the security industry to represent, you know, that hacker culture, as well as, you know, real live hacks. There's a number of folks that worked on the show from the security industry. And so, you know, when you saw the screens actually hacking, you know, there it was, you know, a security researcher or security hacker on the good side that was demonstrating what was actually possible. So there were all accurate skits, and all valid technical information and actually hacking into to test systems and things like that. But it was all to portray, listen, this is real stuff, and we're going to show it to you in a drama series and keep it as accurate as possible to the hacker culture, which I thought was the very first show to ever do it. I always go back to there was an episode of NCIS where if you're familiar with it, you know, there was two of them there. I can't remember. It's been a long time since I've seen them, but I think it was Phoebe and I can't remember the other guy's name, but that one guy's hacking in.
Okay.
And he's like, I can't hack in fast enough. You know, come here, and they start typing on the same keyboard to hack faster. Right. And you're like, oh my gosh. Like I can't take this anymore. I'm going to stop watching the show, you know? So, yeah. But you know, it was really accurate. It was a lot of fun. And, you know, I actually got to talk to Rami Malek and Christian Slater a few times. And it was really cool just to get their perspectives and just kind of hear, you know, they're not computer folks at all. And they loved and ate up, you know, the whole hacking aspect of it, which is really neat.
Yeah, that's really cool. And Christian Slater, he actually went on to be the wolf for those HP printer ads. I don't know if you ever saw that, but it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
He did a good job.
That is cool.
He sounded super knowledgeable. You know what I mean? Like I was watching, I watched this 5-minute printer ad. Like, you know, like that's how you know it's pretty good, but that's really cool.
That's right. He does a great job. They both, you know, the whole team there, Sam Eshmail and Cora Donna, who is I'm a huge fan of. He was the technical producer of Mr. Robot. I mean, just a really humble person and really got into, you know, the spirit of the hacking community, you know, what hackers were and really brought that into the show. And I think it was just by far the best drama series on hackers that we've ever seen before, ever produced.
Awesome. And speaking of, you know, going back, I guess, to social engineering, you created and wrote the social engineering toolkit, and you actually shared that on the Katie Couric show in 2017, from what I saw, because you then considered social engineering to be one of the hardest hacks to protect against. Is that still applicable almost 4 years later?
Absolutely. To give a little bit of a story behind social engineering.
Sure.
You know, when I first got into industry, social engineering wasn't really even considered an attack avenue. You know, everybody was trying to hack through web applications and hacking from the outside. And, you know, social engineering was never talked about as part of that. And an individual named Chris Inagi and I started socialengineer.org. And that's when I created the social engineer toolkit. And that's really where, you know, the awareness around the damages around social engineering really came from. So it's kind of cool to be kind of the first, you know, to really try to introduce that to the security industry.
Yeah.
And, you know, and from there, you know, social engineering became more and more of an attack surface for organizations. We saw that coming, you know, well ahead of time. And, you know, back at the Katie Couric show, that was a fun one because I did a live social engineer where I hacked into, you know, one of the parents and I was spying on her daughter in her own house. I enabled their webcams and things of that effect to, you know, demonstrate the implications of those types of things. And, you know, when that had happened, you know, social engineering was rampant across all organizations, and it still is today. I definitely view social engineering as the most widely attacked surface. When I say surface, you know, that when you look at an attack surface for an organization, you know, what's my vector into an organization to get access to my objective or data that I'm trying to get access to? And social engineering by far is still the number one most effective way. Less time investment. You know, if I'm targeting, let's just say I target six people, and you're targeting a company of 100,000 employees, you know, the six people, okay, well, six fails. Well, I'm just going to go to the next six. And eventually I'll have somebody that I'm successful with. And now I have access to the company and the data that I need. And that's why when you look at ransomware, for example, that's why ransomware is so successful, is because once they have that initial foothold, you know, which really isn't that difficult to get, you know, spreading out and then starting to attack their infrastructure, their online or offline backups, you know, and trying to prohibit them from recovering and then demanding that you pay money back in order to recover your files. I mean, that's a very successful business model for them because of the ease and simplicity that there is. So users are definitely still predominantly the largest risk that we see out there for organizations, and one that, you know, we have to spend a lot of time both from a technological perspective of trying to prevent these types of breaches, but also a preventative in education awareness to train our users to really go about this. The once a year online training that you have to take for 30 minutes, you know, and do a quiz at the end just doesn't cut it anymore. We have to be continuously educating our employees on what's the best way to try to, you know, identify these things. Last story I'll tell, you know, is when I was at Diebold, you know, one thing we used to do is whenever we would get a phishing campaign, we would send that out to the entire company and highlight exactly what they could have looked at in that email to spot that it was you know, phishing. Or if there's a big threat out there at the time, LulzSec, the anonymous group was hacking into Sony and a bunch of other companies. You know, we kept our entire company up to date as those were going on. We had a monthly newsletter with, you know, rewards that were cybersecurity related, you know, where you rack up points and get cash prizes and things like that. You know, we had a really healthy education awareness program, and it made a really big impact on people reporting things and feeling a trust level with security to actually go and do things. So it works really well, and education awareness has to be a big focus for us.
And how else can people protect themselves? Not even, you know, just specifically at work, but just in their daily lives too.
Yeah, that's a great question. And you know, the biggest one that we see today is passwords. Passwords are the most abused thing from an employee or a personal life perspective. A lot of people keep the same password from one system to the next. And what ends up happening is that, you know, there might be a data breach in one of those applications that you've signed up for. And let's just say you have an iOS or Android app and you're getting food delivered to you. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you log in with that and you create a password, and that password is the same somewhere else. What happens is that if that company that you signed up for gets breached, you know, hackers go and try to crack those passwords. And if they crack those passwords, they now have your email address and your password associated to it. And this is what we call credential stuffing. And they have these automatic tools that automatically log into a whole bunch of different sites with that email address and that password, trying to see if they can get access to your personal life, whether it's your Gmail accounts or whether it's your online banking or your social media accounts, and taking those over. Usually one breach causes many. So having unique passwords across those, I'm a huge advocate of password managers. I personally use LastPass, but there's Dashlane, there's Bitwarden, 1Password. There's a number of ones out there that do a great job at protecting your username and passwords. And so those are all key ones that I'd recommend. But I'd also highly implore people to also put in multi-factor authentication on almost any site that you possibly can. And that's, you know, once you enter in your password, it sends you a secondary form of protection. That's usually a text message, or I personally use what are called authenticator apps that essentially give you one-time passwords that are timed through an app on your phone. Those are really good ways of protecting yourself. And, you know, there's other things too, like locking your credit, you know, calling up the major credit card, but the credit bureaus, and having them lock your credit. I'm a huge advocate of the type of companies that monitor your identity and protecting those. And it's not necessarily a state that they're going to be 100% accurate, but one thing that they do really well is if your information does get compromised, they will work with you to fix it up to like a certain, it's each one is different, but like $1 million, $2 million insurance policy essentially. So okay, Helping you fix your credit in the event that your identity is taken. So there's definitely some steps you can take to protect yourself, you know, online. And you know, we're in an age where information, you know, we share so much about ourselves, our lives, our daily routines and everything else. And you just have to recognize that that does create, you know, potential exposure for you, for your family, and everybody else out there.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair. Be safe of what you're sharing. We kind of talk about that a lot, but it never hurts to say it one more time, just in case.
Absolutely.
Help one more person. great. And so you've mentioned and referenced the SolarWinds and Sunburst, but TrustedSec, you actually recently put out an incident response playbook for the SolarWinds backdoor. Why did your team put this out, and what else should folks know about this ever evolving breach?
And this is a big one, and yeah, I don't think people really understand the ramifications of what this means.
Right.
You know, we had a potential nation state that is adversarial to the United States and its allies, go after a private sector company that had very high level access into, you know, they have over 300,000 customers, but specifically for this piece of software, over 18,000 customers. And that includes a wide array of of extremely foundational technological companies like Cisco, Intel, Microsoft, et cetera, as well as, you know, high level government installations, including our nuclear agencies, you know, commerce, treasury, all had this software deployed. So, you know, when we look at supply chain attacks, the reason why they're so damaging, but they are complex in nature, is that, you know, what happened in this situation is that the hackers broke into SolarWinds, and it looks like it's dating back to about 2019, because that's when the initial code was modified. It didn't have the back door then, but code was modified in a unusual manner, which would indicate that they probably had access in 2019. But then they launched the attacks in March. And we don't know the objectives of what they did, but they used the code signing process and the ability to actually insert their own code into the product, which is already trusted by these 18,000 plus customers, and push updates out to them. And there's when the malware in the code was reverse engineered, there's something called domain generated algorithms, or DGAs. And what hackers will do is, you know, once they compromised a system, they have what's called a command and control. So once that server itself, the SolarWinds or Orion server that is being pushed out the new code from SolarWinds, that's code signed and legitimate, when it communicates out to the internet, they generate a domain automatically to establish that connection so that, you know, hopefully it goes undetected. And a bunch of researchers were able to reverse engineer that process. And there was over 1,000 domains in there, which would lead you to believe that there's over 1,000 companies potentially impacted by this. And just yesterday, Microsoft said that they detected these malicious indicators in their own network. So Microsoft was potentially impacted. Now they're saying, you know, it wasn't widespread. They don't know the extent of it yet, but they were potentially targeted with this. Cisco and Intel were on that list as well, as were a number of government installations. So this is a big deal, because essentially, and the allegations are that it was Russia. We don't have full confirmation. We haven't seen the evidence around that. But let's just say Russia, you know, had specific objectives. I mean, they had, you know, a long period of time of going undetected, and essentially any company that they wanted to. And with SolarWinds Orion specifically, it's, you know, often considered more of like a godlike account that has access to everything because of the amount of data that is needed, you know, to monitor network systems and performance and uptimes. It's essentially a monitoring, network monitoring service that needs to log into all your servers. It needs to log into all of your networking devices. So it essentially has full access to your entire company and organization. So this is absolutely devastating for the integrity of our systems, and something that, you know, went undetected for a large period of time. So this is probably one of the largest hacks and breaches that we've seen, at least in my lifetime, that I can recall. And we're just, you know, scratching the surface of what actually happened. It's going to take months to years to understand exactly what this adversary had access to. So, you know, we released the SolarWinds backdoor incident response playbook for responders and what they need to do to conduct both the response aspect of things, the investigation, to actually analyze how far these attackers got into it and how to eradicate it and recover from it in your system. So, you know, and there wasn't really anything out there like this. Okay. And we wanted to give customers as well as non-customers the ability to say, listen, this is our action plan to address this, because it is so unprecedented. And it is such a high level of access that we need to put something out for everybody out there. And so it's been a very popular blog post. And, you know, again, our whole goal is to try to help out, you know, the world from a cybersecurity perspective. And that's really what we focus on.
Well, thank you for putting that out. And sounds like it's really already being helpful for folks and for, you know, so thank you for putting that out. And if there's nothing else, we know that unprecedented is the word of the year.
Yeah, like it sure is, isn't non-stop. It? 2020, man. I recently purchased a DeLorean, as a hobby on the side to convert to the Back to the Future machine.
That's cool.
I was hoping I'd have the full time machine built before so I can get out of 2020, but it's not quite finished yet. So, so I got to work on the flux capacitor.
Yeah, I got to work on that really quick. But that's really cool that. There were only so many of those made, right? I remember
one. Yeah, I think like 3,500 or something like that.
Okay, yeah. Very interesting story around DeLorean as well. And all. I watched a pretty cool documentary on that about the history there. So really cool. Well, David, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. And I really appreciate your line of questioning and everything here. You know, I think the biggest, you know, takeaway from all of this is that, you know, organizations really need to look at their threat models of where potential attackers can come into play and what they can do to build offensive strategies against it. And, you know, we can't continue to do the same thing over and over again. I think 2021, we really need to look at, you know, how do we limit access from our user population, become more of a service oriented, you know, based off of roles within companies, and how do we architect and design our networks to be more resilient to these supply chain attacks. I think we'll be in a much better position going into 2021 and beyond, because I do think that, you know, when successful attacks like this are so prominent and so successful, you know, people look to emulate that. I mean, we saw it with ransomware emulating nation states from an R&D perspective. So, you know, think about what if ransomware had access to SolarWinds and 18,000 plus customers and encrypted them all simultaneously at the exact same time. You know, you're talking probably billions of dollars in you know, payments just to recover their systems, you know, right. And you know, potentially loss of life, outages across the, you know, the world. So, you know, we're kind of on notice now in software development companies, supply chain companies, you know, cloud service providers, MSPs, managed service providers, you know, all need to do a better job at protecting their customers because of the level of access that you have to these organizations. So there's a lot of work to be done, but I'm very positive on the outlook. I think security's come a long way over the past several years that I've been in, you know, over 20 years, I'm getting older, but definitely something that I think will be a major shift and focus for us going into the new year.
Fantastic. Well, David, thank you again.
Thanks so much.
I'm Hillary McClure, Multimedia Director at Cybercrime Magazine. Joining me today was Dave Kennedy, founder of TrustedSec and co-founder and chief hacking officer of Binary Defense Systems. TrustedSec is an information security consulting team at the forefront of attack simulations with a focus on strategic risk management. To learn more about TrustedSec, visit trustedsec.com, and you can listen to all of our podcast episodes at cybercrime.radio.